There we go.
Yeah, I mean, for me, reading Bergman kind of changed the way I saw the world, and it really opened me up to new ways of thinking and new ways of living. And I, from that energy inside me, I wanted to kind of put it out into the world. And that's why I made these videos. I don't think of myself as necessarily well-versed in philosophy. I find it quite challenging, but the one thing I do find that is natural to me is that I really love thoughts. I love thinking, and that's what I feel like I have to contribute. Not that I might have a more technical analysis, or it might be sloppy in areas. And I always kind of put even maybe a disclaimer, this is just my interpretation, but it comes out of a place of like love for these ideas.
I really love these ideas, and I really love thoughts and thinking. I'm just playing back some of the language that I was most attracted to in your exposition there. I'm just going to make a note of that. Maybe we can go back to it later, because I really feel there's something at the identity level that you're expressing when you say what I really love. Mm-hmm. And but Doug, where did you want to start? How did you find out about Matthew, by the way, if I may ask?
Yeah, that's...
Did you find him happenstance or what?
I mentioned that it was a YouTube thread, which we know YouTube threads are not ideal for sharing conversation. And then some of these typed up responses that I did were deleted, as were a few others. So Matt reached out, said... So we communicated through email, and email is a good way to get to know someone. So we had some good in-depth conversation there. And then we opened it up to the forum as well. I thought it would be a good place. It's nice to have a location to place your love of thinking. And that's one of the things we do best. None of us are experts on anything. We obviously don't even have the best microphones or surround sound here. Right now I'm dealing with the windows being replaced, but the love of thought comes through in each time that we have these conversations. So yeah, Matt and I have had two separate conversations the past couple Mondays, I think, or something like that. But I'll keep my talking here short, so it's not drilling and hammering it so much, but yeah.
Great. Where would I like to start? I'm a practitioner of symbolic modeling and clean language. Those are sort of comes out of the work of David Grove, late great David Grove, who passed away about 10 years ago, but I did have a chance to study with him. He was a very, very good therapist, but a real interesting practitioner, a very strange practitioner. I think his, anyway, I trained with him. I trained with some of the people that had trained with him who were doing something slightly different. And I really found it very compelling how he worked with metaphor. And that's my main interest, actually, is doing research in metaphor, which leads back into cognitive linguistics and cognitive semantics and the pioneering work of George Lakoff. Someday, a desired outcome of mine is that we could read Philosophy in the Flesh. This is his big tome, Lakoff's big tome. And I've read almost all of his books. I think you're working on The Metaphors We Live By, is that correct, Doug? You're reading him too, right? Lakoff. Okay.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
So, where would I like to start? That's a good question, because it just seems like there's so much going on. with Matthew's video, with what's going on. I think we shared, this started with a thread on beyond physicalism. So it started with Bernardo Kastrup's work. And Matthew, I think you're the only one who's really commented on that, which I really appreciate. We have done previously some work on Kastrup. We did a whole series on Kastrup's, one of his books, I can't remember which one. So I'm just very interested in what's in the in-between of all of these thinkers that is attracting us personally. And I find with Bergson and what you presented, you don't mind me just jumping right in with—
Oh, go ahead, no.
Okay. Please blow the whistle or something if I'm talking too long. We can pass the baton since there's just three of us here. But I find, I'll just tell you a little personal interest that I have that came out of my work with David Grove, is that he works a lot with modeling space and time through metaphor of the actual physical live person right there in front of him. So he wasn't a philosopher. He was definitely a practitioner. And that's what I consider myself to be, a practitioner. But working with him and learning how he developed, I think, a very novel, innovative approach, and integrating that into my own personality structure has been a challenge. I come out of gay politics. I was very involved in the 90s and the gay movement. I confess, a movement junkie. I am into movements. I'm not too much, I'm very interested in what's going on in the individual, but I'm also interested very much in what happens to individuals when they get together and try to come up with a desired outcome that they all can share that is strong enough to mobilize their resources in a certain direction, which of course, if you've gone through the postmodern as I have, you realize how easily projects like the, shared projects and outcomes, desired outcomes that motivate people can easily get derailed unless there's some sort of precautions or some sort of a deep grounding of some of the individuals in the group so that these movements can take off. So that's where I'm at right now. And I find, how can we, Matthew, Doug, John, today, right here and now, co-create a movement? I think all of it, many of us are lone wolves. That's our metaphor. Doug, you want me to do my wolf? Let me see if I can do it. Ooh. Okay, so I've been a lone wolf for a very long time. And I'm sure many of us who study philosophy are very drawn to, you know, for various reasons, that lone wolf metaphor. I think that is what draws me constantly and keeps attracting me to watching these archives of these conversations with maybe 5, 6, sometimes more than that, groups, and seeing, well, what's circulating and what are the motifs or the metaphors that keep coming back? And how can we work with that consciously? That's, I think, the big challenge. And I think what's happening with Bernardo Kastrup, I thought what was most interesting about him is his recognition of, we have all that, we have our individual cognition, and we can, through introspection, explore that if you're good at it. Not most philosophers, well, many philosophers are not very good at it, but those who are, and I think Bergson was one of them. I think certainly William James was one of them. This was, I think, a very heightened capacity to introspect. Then move into, and then to represent one's representations, what Bernard is calling re-representation, which I think is what a lot of the meta-theorists are doing. But all of that gets very ungrounded without taking into consideration the vast background of the perceptual space that people are coming from. Or what Bernardo calls the phenomenal. So I think his map, his model which I hope we can contrast and compare a little bit to some of the models that you're working with and that Bergson was developing. How do we meta model, look at all of these models, and how do we come up with something that works, that actually works? And I think Bernard has done a magnificent job of trying to take apart or deconstruct the physicalist paradigm by looking very much at their language. And I think he does it through an analytic approach. I think it's a very interesting one. And it disarms them quite a bit because they're not used to having a PhD computer programmer, analyzing them the way they easily debunk the non-physicalists. They're not used to being debunked on their own turf. And I think that's his strategy. But it's not one that I can perform, but I can certainly learn from. So I'm just putting that on the table as another model, Bernardo's model. And I'm very interested in how your model of Bergson and the occult, could there be a relationship between those approaches? And that's a big meta question, which I'm putting on the table here. And I hope that can be of use and delight to us. Maybe we can do something with this. And I'm very curious about your response, Matthew, your response, Doug. And I have more to say, but I want to press the pause button and put on my listening cap here and pay as much attention as I can to the metaphorical constructs which we're using. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. That was a very nice envisioning of the environment that we're working in. Two things that I have written down here that I was thinking about bringing up, which tie in exactly with what you were talking about, is that I think that Bergson would have really liked Lakoff. And I think that in Bergson's first chapter in Time and Free Will, he's performing a questioning of our philosophical questions and trying to see where metaphors have infiltrated these questions. And I can go in more on that. But when you posted the video on Castro, it kind of caught me like fire on dry kindling. I think mainly because it shows a different vision in a different language to the way I've interpreted matter and memory. And it even made me realize that I, in a way, see matter and memory as a fitting into a type of idealism. It has a very different character and feel than the one I get from Kastrup, but there's many similarities between them two. And I think that they've helped me understand each other. They're not reducible to one another. And I immediately went, watched the course that you posted and his deconstruction of materialism is invaluable. It was a really cogent, and his ability to articulate in these really simple ways is very powerful. So then I went and I was like, this is fascinating. So I bought his book, Why Materialism is Baloney. And a lot of the same stuff was covered, but I found reading it very interesting. And what I really took note of was that he ends up in a very similar place as I do in my occult series on Bergson, a place where reincarnation, communication with the dead, these things are reframed because we have a different understanding of the individual that's not tainted with our spatial metaphors that allows us to think these more or less usually ridiculed ideas that have to do with communication with the past, what it means to be an individual subject, reincarnation, what happens when we die, and we come to very similar places. I don't know if you watched the third video in my series, but I give an account of the subject and our reformulation of the individual subject. So yeah, so those are the two areas where I'm just seeing these connections. I'm not even to make it, they just jumped out at me and they caught me really strongly. And I was very excited in thought for the past 2 weeks.
Thank you. And Doug, I just read Tim Wargo's book? Yeah, on time loops.
Sure.
You know that book?
Yeah, I read Time Loops, yeah.
Okay, this one is his new book. I think, I didn't read the first one. This is the one I read on his dream work, precognitive dream work and the long self.
Yeah.
And as you guys may know better than I, he draws upon the idea of block universe. So, and I have problems with that. I think most people do. It's sort of so counterintuitive. However, if you've had anomalous experiences, as I have, and some of them I've shared, it's hard to, what is most disturbing about these anomalous experiences is that we don't have any good models for these anomalous experiences that I think are widely shared now. I think there was a time when, sort of underground movement, the various kinds of occult groups got together. But I now think that the underground is now pretty much available to anybody who's interested in it. And it's all online. You don't have to go to Tibet to find out who's doing the most esoteric stuff. The books are out there, the research is out there. And this also creates a lot of, a lot of tension, because you're ending up having to hold the tension between incommensurabilities in ways that previous generations probably did not have to do, because they didn't have so much access to so much contrary information. Anyway, I'm sharing that with you guys because I think there is a relationship between Wargo's work and Bergson's work, although it isn't made explicit by Wargo. I think that the big debate between Einstein and Bergson, which I have heard had a huge cultural impact, that Einstein is widely considered to be the winner of that debate. And Bergson was sort of lampooned for even trying to debate with Einstein. That's not a good idea. But I think those of us, there are some people who are restudying that debate, and I'm looking at it again. And I just looked at Matt Segal had a 15-minute video that he presented. I don't know whose research he's looking at, but it's revisiting that Einstein Bergson clash. But it seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong or if you have a different take on this, and I'm sure you both of you do. It seems to me that it's a clash between first person science and third person science. I don't think Bergson was doing something that wasn't scientific. I think he wasn't just doing poetry. I think he was defending a very, a very first person account. Whereas working with the imaginative, flights of fancy, which Einstein was a master of, we forget almost all of his discoveries came out of his first person kinesthetic, proprioceptive, highly imaginative, experience. And then he later found the mathematics and the physics and all of that, and the technique and the technical language to support his intuitions. So he was very intuitive scientists. Both of them are very intuitive, but I think it's that kind of detachment and that that Einstein sort of took it to, he was looking at the third person, although he was quite adept at first person accounts. He tended to zoom out into third person and create the mathematical, create a kind of mathematical underpinning for a certain kind of orientation, which no one can really embody. I mean, we're not going to get in spaceships. We're not going to get one twin on the Earth, one twin in a spaceship, and go out to the edge of the galaxy and come back and measure how much either one of those twins has aged. You know, that's not going to ever happen. But and to use that as a method for sort of declassifying or re-categorizing our perceptual or our phenomenal experience, I think this is the clash. And I think it's still actually ongoing. I think it went underground and it's coming back, I believe. I think it's being retrieved by yourself, Matthew. And I think, and Matthew Segal and others who are, and in his own way, Bernardo Castro. And you and me, Doug, we've been working on this for quite a while now. So I hope some of that's of use and we can move that forward if you guys want to develop any of that. Thanks. Love to hear your response to that, Doug, too, about Tim Wargo and Bergson, if there's a relationship.
Yeah, I think even Matt and I noticed that he had read Time Loops, Matt had, but not the precognitive dream work. But in both books, he does reference the block universe, which we kind of take issue with because that relates to the notion of free will. It relates to that you're talking about first and third person, and there's also the transcendent versus the relative, I suppose. And I guess in reference to the Matt Segal video, I think.
Oh, you saw it?
I think I did. I don't know.
It just came out a few days ago.
Probably not then. I think he's talked about Bergson before.
Yes, he has. Yeah.
Focusing on, at least in that debate between Einstein and Bergson, I feel like Einstein was understood by the crowd or by society at that time, because that's kind of the direction that science was moving in. And Bergson, I think, agreed with Einstein while also disagreeing and saying there's still something that underlies this relative position. And maybe it's, I don't know if I fully agree that it's like a God figure that I think Matt has referenced to before. It's more, or this transcendental figure. So yeah, in that debate, I think Bergson was highly misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And perhaps even to this day, but I know Matt takes it in the direction of Whitehead, who does kind of take Bergson's theories of time and places it within the cosmos or within this framework that, and I don't know too much about Whitehead and what he would respond, his response to the block universe would be, and might be all sorts of oddities going on. But we know about quantum mechanics. Someone else we explored but haven't discussed too much is Alexander Wendt, who I think also disagrees with this block universe aspect. I forget the other author I referenced saying that we need a new theory of time in the thread. Bob Rosenberg, I think, is his name.
Oh, yes.
But he, in that same essay, he directly references his beef with Eric Wargo, and that he doesn't quite, kind of exactly what we're talking about here, that his focus on the block universe, it kind of makes sense with the way he's wanting his theory to work. But then at the same time, it is a challenge to place free will within within this predetermined framework. And once you get into the time frame of where time fits into all the past and future and the relation to the present, and there's so many loopings that go on, that it does contradict a few things. That's all I'll say there.
I'm glad that this conversation is going between Bergson and Eric Wargo, because I thought, you know, those are probably two thinkers that might not get associated too often, but they're both very much about time. And I have so much to say on this because they've created a lot of friction in me. Because on one hand, you know, I find that Bergson speaks to me because of his very awareness of what it's like to be alive. So I resonate with Bergson a lot. I feel like it describes or it infers my experience accurately. Now, when I read Eric Wargo, it's somewhat in direct contrast to Bergson, although there's some similarities, but Bergson is kind of reliant that the future is radically open. And Wargo is predicated on the very there's no chance that the future is open. It's completely closed. And I think this has much to do with first and third person. And I don't know how much sense this is going to make right now, but I'm going to try to do it anyway. One book that has had a profound impact on me was Deleuze's book on Nietzsche. And he basically gives, the way I see it, two accounts of what we could think of Nietzsche's eternal return. And in a sense, if we think about it in as a what Deleuze calls as a sedentary distribution, it's the return of the same, right? So it's all there and it returns. But if we think about it, I mean, how could the same thing return without being collapsed into a unity? So Deleuze approaches it from what he calls a nomadic distribution, which is where he becomes aware that what returns is difference. Difference is that which returns. And now tying this into Wargo, I've noticed I've had precognitive experiences, ones that are jolting, to say the least. But what happens when the precognition is fulfilled is still a newness. If you were imagining the future exactly as it was, you would just be in the future. The affirmation of it coming true creates a dimension of novelty. So there's like, that's kind of like how I'm saying, even in the Eric Wargo model where the future is closed, there's still a dimension of newness. And that's how I begin to think of these two working together. Because, yeah, I mean, I'll leave it there. I hope that made sense.
Yes, it did. It just seems to me the question I have is, to Wargo, is it's open and closed to whom?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows that? And it just seems to me, and he's quite brilliant, I think, in offering all kinds of techniques for activating this kind of not futurism, what do you call it? Not paranormal, but it's the precognitive. Mm. But he calls it, he sort of calls it a category of person he calls precogs. But I think it's it just seems to me, aesthetically, it doesn't work for me. because it just makes, and I think a lot of people don't like it. But I think the problem for me is, and I have to go into this a little more detail than I'm really prepared to go in, but some of the, what you're talking about, the communication with the dead,
yeah,
and that being, and not tainted with the, with spatial metaphors. I mean, I assume culturally supported consensus reality metaphors, which we all are, you know, embedded in and are acting out inevitably. But to the extent that these anomalies occur, it seems that they are happening to someone in a certain context, and that, or otherwise the anomalies would be ignored. And many, often there's great social rewards for ignoring them. And there are also some great social deficits if you tend to pay a lot of attention to them publicly. So I think it's like, how does each person sort of make sense of these experiences? And I think it's great that Wargo has done the pioneering work that he's done, but I think that there were many pioneers before him, and there will be many pioneers after us, but that before and after orientation, which makes history possible, which makes our jurisprudence possible, which makes going to the store and buying milk possible. I mean, all these, what's before and what's after, it's what's and what's during, or what's in between the before and after, it's extremely important. So there is a sequence, it's sequential. One thing happening after another thing. Of course, in between that, there's also the simultaneous and the nonlinear. But I have a lot of problems, but I'll put a pause on that. Just go back a little bit and look at Deleuze, and I haven't read his book on Nietzsche. I'm looking forward to it. I did read his book on Francis Bacon, the artist.
I just read it. I loved it.
Yeah, it's awesome. That is awesome. And I have read his What is Philosophy, which is really good, which is very good. But I think what you mentioned about the eternal return and his reference, Bergsonism. He wrote a book on Bergsonism. That's why I was suggesting that as a possible reading. Yeah. Can you hear me? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, the eternal return of Nietzsche, the return of the same, and he's saying, Deleuze is saying the return of difference. I'm saying it's sort of return not of the same, but of the similar. So I think these words, same, similar, difference, overlap considerably.
Yes.
But I think this is sort of an aside, another rabbit hole we could go in, but McLuhan, and I think I've referenced him, and some of you guys are commenting upon it and may have some experience of reading his work. But I think McLuhan, and Deleuze did not like McLuhan. He was into the plane of immanence.
And but I think it's because they're doing the same thing. I think just from a very like far, far away, when I was listening to that Weird Studies podcast and they were talking about probes, I was like, that's exactly kind of what Deleuze meant by concepts. And Deleuze liked to think through people. How could he think through someone that was thinking through? That's why I see their conflict. Sorry to interject.
No. That's a perfect thing to say, because thinking through that prepositional orientation, thinking through, thinking above, thinking beside, thinking below. I think those prepositional phrases that we all use are pointing to something in our perceptual space. And we should pay attention to that. And I do. I mean, I'm very curious about how people gesture and where they gesture to. And it's sort of like what Lakoff was talking about time. We can retrieve time and we can receive time, but they're different directions. I think to retrieve, I can't remember exactly his body language, but there's a going out and a getting it. And then there's, I think that's retrieval. And then there's a, there are other ways of, but it's either, it's coming at us.
Yeah.
So time is coming at us. Christmas is on its way. It's coming at us. So there's a, it's coming at you, or you can go out and you can get it. But I think these orientations in space, in our perceptual space, brings to our attention how time is not friction free. It's actually someone has to be embodying it in some curious kind of way. And we want to share things with other people, like knowledge and understandings and commitments we make. How are we going to do that? If it's all preordained and it's sort of a block universe and there's not equal access to it, I think it just seems to me full of things that just don't make sense. Because as a person who's been a part of several kinds of social movements and who's invested in a liberatory orientation that to time and to space, that we have to find the place for certain events to happen. There has to be a context for it. The timing could be off. The timing could be just right. And you really never know unless you know what you want and you know what the other guy wants, other guy or gal wants. And you know, you can sort of mobilize towards something that you may think is better. But how in the world are you going to do that if you're operating from a block universe orientation? You can't. There's no points to it. It's pointless. You will motivate no one to get off their ass and do anything if you live in a block universe. So I'm just sharing that with you guys. Maybe there's a different response that you have or something similar.
I just wanted to add to the eternal return of difference. I like how you said it's the return of the similar. And I wanted to add Bergson's influence on how he perceived time was Felix Ravaillassin, another French thinker who wrote a book on habit. And I guess in summary, that at least the catchphrase from the book, which it doesn't really have one, but if you were to sum it up, is that habit is second nature. So it's the return of nature in a certain sense. I don't think I can do the book justice, but that's kind of sums it up there, that for me, what we're talking about here, there's also perhaps levels, not necessarily levels, but different kinds of returning elements. And some are more structured or fossilized in a certain sense. So our body habits, physical, biological, spatial body returns just as it is every day. But psychologically, in our dreams, the body can become anything it wants to. One of the things I was drawn to in Matt's third video on the occult was the inhabiting of two different personalities within a dream. I think something along those lines you mentioned, but I have had dream experiences where I embody another person while at the same time I know I'm still me. Mm-hmm. So I'm in this other person's body and thinking as they would, while at the same time I'm me thinking I'm me. That's only possible in the imaginative realms. So when we add these different dimensions of what I'm calling habit based on Bergson's influence and then Deleuze, I really want to read Difference and Repetition because I know there's something in there that really, he's such a deep, interesting thinker that I know there's something in there that explains what I want to explain, but I can't. And so yeah, there are these various modes or levels or elements to the return, which takes us into the element of time. So the block universe perhaps maybe holds the physical, but then we get into these different elements of psychological, spiritual, the unseen, and that cannot be framed as easily as something like a body.
That's great, Doug. Thank you. And Matthew, did you want to chime in?
Yeah, I kind of just wanted to comment on basically what both of you were saying. I find the idea of the block universe or that my future is determined extremely unnerving. I don't know if I'm just speaking from my ego that wants to be in control, or that there's a deeper kind of sense of unnerving there. I had to put the book, the Time Loops book, down many, I found it difficult to read, not because of its language or its concepts, but its implications. Even if the future is set, I don't want to know it. That's just my opinion there. And then another thing too, and this is just something I would want to ask Wargo, is that, you know, say we had a precognitive faculty in like a Philip K. Dick sense, and we could actually see a probability of events, and that precognition could, in a paradoxical way, alter what the future is, there'd be no way to recognize it. You know, the premonition that makes it possible that, say I had a premonition that I was gonna get hit by a train, and so I avoided the train tracks that day, and what would have happened was I would have got hit by a train that day. You would just say that, well, that wasn't a real premonition because you never got hit by a train. Well, that's just stripping the agency away from the kind of ability to maybe peer into something like the future. I don't see why that's not a possibility. Yeah. And then just to kind of reiterate what I was saying about the return, in from a first person's perspective, what returns is difference. So you can never, Bergson reveals this quite clearly. You know, I go to a restaurant for the first time. That's an experience. I go there again. Simply by being there prior, it combines into my new experience. This is kind of profound. It's cumulative. Consciousness is cumulative. I think it works that way for the future too. That's what I was trying to get at. If we have a premonition, then it comes true. The premonition and the actualization of it synthesize into a new being. This has profound effects. I was reading Bergson for the first time, and I was at a very routine job I didn't like too much. And for a little while, I realized everything esoterically to me, not exoterically, was new. Yeah, I walked down the same street, gone on the same bus, did the same thing, but everything in experience is new. It's only our concepts that cover up over it. So I'm resonating with what you both said. I think I just wanted to clarify on that return of difference, and then comment on the kind of deeply unnerving kind of aspect to a block universe and where that arises. I'm not sure.
Well, I think I've never been a proponent of free will. I'm a proponent of constrained will. I think will is constantly being challenged by everyday life, but and what's the relationship between will and agency? I think a lot of there's a lot of probability in the new physics. That's pretty much all there is probability, because you know we're just an excitation on a wave according to the new physics. So you can't say exactly where it is. You there's can no say moment, right, right. Yeah. So you're talking about an excitation of a wave, which is never separate from the ocean, but you can't predict where it's going to end up, but there are probabilities.
Yes.
And that's what the new physics is paying attention to, rather than the old classical physics, which should have been thrown out a long time ago, but still people are operating in that mindset. And it trickles down, unfortunately, and into our psychology and our politics for sure. But I think that tension between probability and predictability and control and influence interests me a great deal, because I always thought, like I said, I'm using the gay movement and my personal experience in that movement and how it was aligned with other movements, with the women's movement and other ethnic groups, the Black civil rights movement, the environmental movement. All these movements overlapped in certain degree. But I think what influence do you have? What can you control? My experience is I can control very little, mm-hmm. but I can influence quite a lot. Mm. And I can certainly influence a lot more if I'm with other people who share that belief with me. And I think that's where our sense of personal agency is activated, when we're in certain groups, which have a strong a fidelity to an agent. And I think the zombie nation, it would be the result if more and more people just drop that and ascribe to a block universe. You know, mm-hmm. I think we already have it. It's already here in a lot of the AI and posthumanism and transhumanism thinking. I think just a sort of recycling very old ideas. These are not that new, actually. So I think this is why studying McLuhan is of such interest to me, because he talks about retrieval. I'm trying to take notes here because things are going by so quickly. But what does this new thing? Oh, he's talking about human artifacts. So I'm just going to share with you his four questions, which comes out of media and formal cause. So he's very interested in cause. And it goes back to Aristotle, differences, different kinds of causes. There's the efficient, there's the material, there's the formal, and then there's the final cause. Our culture relies a lot on material and efficient causes, but rejects entirely formal cause and final cause. That's all teleology. That's all spooky. What did Einstein say? Movement at a distance, whatever. But I think McLuhan and his son, who co-wrote this book, they were working with the challenges in their particular circle. You know, I mean, they're literary theorists, basically. He was proposing theories about media, but he was attacked by a very scientistic group of people, you know, who always were, what's your evidence, what's your proof? And so he said, okay, how can we do this scientifically? And they came up with four interesting questions. What does the new thing, this is in the study of human artifacts, what does this new thing enlarge, enhance, or amplify? What does it retrieve or bring back in a new way? What, when it is pressed to an extreme, is the area of reversal? How does it flip? How does it make superfluous or obsolete? So I put this on a little cross. I don't know if you guys can see it, but there's like enhance up here. What does this new thing enhance?
Would the new thing be like finding the artifact, the discovery of a?
Well, I like my practice, symbolic modeling. What does that enhance? Okay. What does it amplify? Yeah. What does it retrieve? What is it? How does it? What does it flip? What does it reverse? I would say like Bergson, for instance. You could put Bergsonism in this little right here. And you could say, well, what does Bergsonism or Platonism or Deleuze, what is enhanced? Mm-hmm. What is retrieved? What is obsolesced? What is reversed? So I'm not an expert at this. This is way premature that I should be presenting this, but I think there is a relationship between what he's calling these as a tetrad. Mm-hmm. What he's calling tetrads and what's happening in our daily lives. So he's saying, you don't have to go to the future. The future's right here. Yeah. The future is everywhere. You just have to be sort of primed to pick up on it. And same thing with the past, for sure. So I think right now in our internet age, which he was, it was in his future. He died before the personal computer became common, but he made all kinds of predictions or probabilities. But I think that he was saying we were transiting the electric age, moving into a digital age, and that it would create all kinds of conditions that were novel. And it could go in many different directions, but using these four questions and thinking like a tetrad, he was like, what will the digital age enhance? What will it retrieve? What will it reverse? What will it obsolesce? And I think he and his son, Eric, worked on this and doing many different kinds of tetrads. I think, oh gosh, he has a whole, it's in another book, I'll have to find it. But I think that if you just look at the digital age, it enhances in some ways that things that were happening in the electric age, like TV. But now what it is enhanced in a way, we're all on TV right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what does it, and he goes into obsolescence and reverse, but I'm interested in what does like the internet, the digital age, we're all members and participants of and shapers of and are shaped by, what does it retrieve? And his, I think, very provocative idea was that it retrieves the medieval age. It retrieves the scribal. It retrieves groups of people getting together and reading books and talking out loud about them, which is exactly what we're doing now. So I think this is, but it will be a different medieval age. It won't be the one that happened in, I don't know which centuries. But I think that idea really, I really enjoy that idea because it makes sense to me. And I think it ties in with something, with a lot of what we experience as, and what Wargo is really documenting really well is how our reading, how that the angel of the library hovers around us. You know, the book will fall off the shelf and hit us on the head and the page will open and you'll look at it and the exact thing you're looking for, the answer to your question is right there, you know? So I think these kinds of precog experiences, I don't know if you call those precog or some form of telepathy, but there's something going on. And I think we've all had these weird kind of experiences that are not easily explained in by the popular cultural models that we have. And anyway, I think the McLuhan study could really fit in really well with the Bergson and with the Kastrup. I think they overlap considerably. And it's maybe part of our, you know, something that we can do together that could never have been done by people before. You know, we have this kind of access where different parts of the world, people are lighting up in certain ways and they can't find people in their immediate environment to support that. So they go online and find some other weirdo. And you can find them, they're out there, you know. But how do we ground this and bring it into our, you know, everyday social spaces? I think it's the big question mark for all of us. So, you know, I'm just sharing that. I hope some of that made sense to you guys. Thanks.
It made a lot of sense. I've been talking a lot, Doug. Do you have anything to say?
I've got a lot of background noise right now, so I'll hold off.
Well, we have, I don't know how long we've chosen for this call. It's 12:17. We've been speaking a little over an hour. Maybe another 20 minutes. Would that be okay with you guys?
Sure.
Yeah. Because I would like, I sort of see this as just a meet and greet kind of opportunity, and we're putting new ideas on the table, and how they will organize will be a lot about what do each of us want to have happen in this forum. And so, Matthew, I'm really grateful that you're influencing us in the way you have, and that you'll feel, you know, comfortable bringing your research to us, and that we could create research, more research together. I think it's, what did Aaron Manning call it? Creation, research creation. I think we're sort of engaged in that big time. So and it takes I think new skills that the internet, certainly persons my age who are functioning most of their adult life without the internet, all of a sudden we have to get up to speed. And I feel like it's interesting because now a younger generation that had never had anything but the internet are now reaching maturity. So I think that's a very interesting and stimulating kind of intergenerational interplay that's happening right now. So, and all of this is happening post-pandemic. Hopefully it's post-pandemic, or maybe the pandemic is only getting started. We really don't know yet. But I think in a strange kind of way, we're retrieving the Black Death. You know, it's the old medieval, really scary stuff that, you know, people died of not just famine and flood, but they died of plagues. And this to me is a reprise. What the pandemic has brought back to me is the 80s, the AIDS epidemic in Manhattan, where, you know, the subculture or the other culture that I was a part of, we were under particularly intense stresses that others were not, you know, were not dealing with. But I think that what this pandemic has retrieved, in my memory at any rate, is like, and what's different is that existential anxiety that overwhelmed and reorganized the gay culture. I think that's happening globally now. So it isn't just a small group of people. Mm-hmm. It's happening all over the planet simultaneously, is having to deal with these stressors. And I don't think it's over yet. I think in some ways it's just getting started. The kind of ramifications and the new kinds of surveillance that are going to be imposed, which, you know, before pandemic would be considered the weirdest kind of dystopian fantasy. But now we're living in it right now. As everyone has to have their, you know, their barcode, you know, and checked if you want to go into a restaurant or a theater. These are the kind of weird kind of scenarios that I think leave some of us, you know, who hoped that this technology would be used for our liberation, mm-hmm. Really appalled, you know. But I'm not the only one who's complaining. I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are very disturbed by this. But I'm just seeing how much of our discourse is corralled, is still trying to be corralled into, you know, an us versus them polarized kind of politics, for sure. But I'm just trying to say that new kinds of skills, new kinds of persons who can sort of handle this kind of cognitive dissonance and hold these tensions long enough so that something new can be retrieved, or something new can be, or something can be obsolesced or reversed. Because inevitably that will happen if there are enough persons who can hold the tension and have those kinds of expectations and say, oh yeah, I can feel the vibe. This is the future, and the future's here. Or, oh yeah, this is something that is being obsolesced now, and there are a lot of people who are pissed off about that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think there's a practical use to playing with these tetrads, and I hope doing what I'm doing today is sort of like a real rough rehearsal for something that I hope will happen in our shared future. Mm-hmm.
So, thanks. Do you know if the tetrad was based upon, I know he was highly Catholic. I was just wondering if the actual four elements were based upon like four archetypal type of elements as well. But
I wouldn't be surprised, and I'm not an expert on this. So I'm
yeah,
just
maybe that's something we can explore at some point.
Because I knew he was, I think if you've listened to Martel and Phil Ford in the Weird Studies podcast, they titled it McLuhan the Mystic. But if he was a mystic, he was a Christian one, because he was definitely a Catholic. But anyway, that's part of the mix. And maybe why he was claiming that we are retrieving the medieval scribal mind.
Yeah. You see the young is a very kind of has ties to like medieval, a lot of medieval symbology and stuff. And he's very much about the quaternity. I mean, you see thinkers across time dividing things into four. It's quite
or threes.
Yeah, yeah, I would say there's a missing four. Yeah. But yes, three for sure.
There's a tension between the triad and the four. And I think that's an interesting tension too, which many of us may be embodying in very strange ways, I suspect.
What do you think how would Eric Wargo fit into this tetrad?
I don't know that I know Eric Wargo that well. That would be a great question to ask him. But that is a good question. Doug, do you have a response to that?
Just off the cuff, what he brought forth for me, aside from we've already noted the block universe kind of takes away the lived element, elemental experience that makes life worth living. But he does retrieve Freud as someone yes. who I've recently started to explore. I always put aside his books because I thought it would be too focused on the said theories, and everybody said, oh, he's too sexually focused or focused on specifics. But I sat down and read Interpretation of Dreams, and it's a profound book. You can see why he was so influential. And his resources are very interesting as well. But I think Eric Wargo is interested in the occult, definitely. So he kind of retrieves that notion for me of just being able to think it in real time rather than kind of shove it aside. It's all around us. So and his latest offering of the precognitive dream work, he does say that, of course, it's not going to be prophecies after prophecy after prophecy. This is just everyday occurrences. But it does enhance when we observe what's going on at night. It enhances the day, and it has this cyclical effect on how we dream and how we live. So there's the retrieval. What is he retrieving? I don't know I want to go into
What is reversed?
Reversal. I guess he's actually literally reversing time.
Yeah.
So
what about what is obsolesced?
In Wargo.
Agency.
Yes. Yeah.
That's a good one.
Which is probably why I'm triggered by it, because I'm definitely I definitely think the agentic aspect of our nature is being run over by a lot of our technology. Yeah.
I think so. Sorry.
No. Yeah. But I think a new kind of agency is coming forward now that's been hopefully refined by the recent disasters that have happened around the world. And, you know, and my resistance to the medicalization of humanity is very front and center. For a lot of people, that's totally background, and they're not even paying attention to it until one day they wake up and they realize their body is not their own. They have a barcode on them, which permits them certain kinds of constraints that are imposed on them, and others have certain kind of freedoms. And this is like, has been technologized in a way that the Nazi concentration camp, those who designed the Nazi concentration camps, could never have come up with something like this, you know? But now it's going to be activated very soon, I think, unless there are people who have a sense of agency who can, and I think it will be a new kind of expression of agency. Then I'm hoping that's retrieved rather than, you know, as we all know, people just sit around and kvetch and complain, why doesn't someone do something, you know? And I understand that. I can be one of those people too. But I think there's something about threat and existential crisis that can mobilize people in ways that they would not be mobilized if they didn't feel a threat. So in a way, I think the opportunities now, if we were to put pandemic in this, and what does the pandemic enhance? What does the pandemic retrieve? What does it obsolesce? What does it reverse? I think we could collectively come up with all kinds of interesting notions, possibilities, probabilities, and use our imaginations. And I think that's where I would like to do sort of a clean language, which I've done with my friend Seth, who wasn't here today, but he couldn't make it. But he did look at your videos, Matt, and he had a question. So I'll post his question before we leave. But I think there's something about, what I would like to have happen, my desired outcome for the group would be to explore this, the tetrads, using our experience of the pandemic as, I don't know what I don't have the language for this yet, but if we put the pandemic in the middle and we ask these four questions, and then I could use clean questions about whatever individual response a person had. I could ask them very, I think the clean language technology, which I haven't shared with you, Matthew, but which Doug knows really well, it's paying attention to the language a person actually uses and ask them open-ended questions about their own language. So, and to just give you an example, I worked with a client, and she was working with all kinds of issues, but about self-esteem and her functioning and her work and stuff like that. But at one point, I don't know exactly what the cluster questions I asked her were, but she identified a very helpful presence. And I said, "And where is that helpful presence?" And she said, "Oh, he's right over there." And she pointed about 10 feet into the corner of the room where we were. And I said, "And when over there, helpful presence," and she already labeled him a he, right? "Is there anything else about him over there?" And she gave a description of him, a very vivid one. And I sort of, "And when," using all her descriptors, "over there, helpful presence, what does he want to have happen?" And she said, "Oh, he wants all kinds of good things for me. And he's very supportive." And so that's just by zeroing in on her language and asking her questions, she was able to contact and externalize in her perceptual space this benevolent being. And she identified him later as her brother. He was her brother. She had no brothers in her biological family, but this person she identified as her brother, who'd always been there for her. And at the end of the session, what happened was I started asking her, "Well, is there a relationship between the issues that she had at work, the issues she had in her problem, and this person over there?" And she said, "Oh, he's not over there anymore." And I said, "Well, where is he?" And she said, "He's in here." And so it was very interesting to me, and I thought that was important. If you look at the system, that the location of that helpful presence was no longer outside of her, but was inside of her. So I'm just sharing that with you because what status does that presence that she identified in her perceptual space have? I think I have no problem saying, well, it's an imaginal perceptual space. It's not a space that I share with her intersubjectively. I don't see it, but she does. And I'm honoring that. This is her phenomenological space, and she can say whatever the hell she wants about anything. And I can't like it or dislike it. And I'm not necessarily neutral about it either, but I'm just looking at it's sort of like this. This is sort of like looking at a Möbius strip. If you sort of deconstruct a Möbius strip, you'll see that there's a part of the this is actually a Klein bottle. There's a part of the Klein bottle that is contained. There's a part of the Klein bottle that is not contained. And then there's a part of the Klein bottle that is neither contained nor, it is neither contained nor can, it is not inside or outside. It is neither inside nor outside. Now, recently I read Timothy Morton who said, it's either or, both and. And he said, neither nor is crazy and it's nihilist and it leads to nihilism. which most Buddhism I think would then qualify as nihilistic. But I'm just saying in many of these exchanges we have in normal social spaces, so-called normal. But if you go into an unusual social spaces I had with my client who identified this beneficial presence in the corner of the room that later became inside of her. Now there are some who say, well, that's kind of crazy, you know, that kind of person should be on Xanax, you know, or she has trouble with her boundaries. I didn't bring any of that baggage in there. I just accepted all of her messages and worked with it because I had a technique to do that. But I also think we're touching into that. It's inside, is it on the inside? Is it on the outside? Is it neither on the inside or the outside? I think that can happen within our own sensorium when we're having these anomalous adventures, but it can also happen in the intersubjective spaces that we share with others who are reporting to this, to us, their anomalous experiences. But I'm not in a position really to debunk because it's never happened to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have some kind of reality. So I think anyway, that's part of my research that I would like to bring into the mix too, is how could I, honor these experiences that I witnessed and honor the experiences of groups of people who have gotten their desired outcomes, like the civil rights movement, many of those persons who gave up their lives. I mean, others have benefited from that. And I just think, and when those sodomy laws were struck down by the Supreme Court, gay people were given the right to get married, can adopt children, all that. This didn't come accidentally or from a block universe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nor did it come from a group of people who had plenty of evidence to support what they wanted, because we had no evidence at all, but we knew what we wanted. So this is where my question is, where is our social creativity or these liberation movements going to come from? And what will be the theories that support and nourish those and nurture those aspirations? If we can do that, some of the groundwork here, that some of the heavy lifting for that theorizing here, I think we'd be doing a great service.
I think that all of this is intimately tied with what we can't really describe, but it has to do with agency, freedom. And I would like to propose a word that I feel comfortable with, because we have a lot of associations with freedom and control, but you know, at least Bergson has showed me that freedom is the liberation. It's liberated from control. But I like the word expression, because it's not so much confined to these things. And I think, Colin Wilson, mm-hmm. he said it well. He said, we can't give a positive, coherent account of freedom, but we know exactly what it is when it's taken away. Right. And right. I think that's a very, very powerful statement. I think the relationship of inside and outside and how we formulate ourselves in those terms is very related to ideas of agency, expression, the triumph of rationality. I don't know Gebser well, but it seems to me that the perspectival is kind of like, has to do with like inhabiting a specific point and making observations as an individual. And that's kind of like where we discredit people's, for lack of a better word, inner experiences, because we have this skewed idea that we have, it's like we do have interiors, it's a good language, but it's also problematic, runs us into a lot of errors, not errors, but problems, I watched that Lakoff video you sent, and I think it was number 4 of the lecture series. I started watching it from the beginning after I watched 4, but he said, you know, a lot of the philosophical questions we ask arise from us not realizing that there's metaphors in our language. And then so we get like tangled in these, and all these metaphors are inherently, they have to do with the body. And so they're going to be spatialized, and Bergson would be right with him there.
I want to ask you, and since you brought up that spatialized, I'm my friend Seth, I wish you could have met him. He knows a lot about the occult. He's also an artist and a musician.
Is he on the forum?
He's been on, I guess, on the forum a couple of times.
Okay.
But he's not a regular like Doug and I are, but he comes and goes on occasion. If there's a topic that I think he's interested in, he often comes and joins us for some of the symbolic modeling stuff I've done, because he's a practitioner of that as well. So we have that in common. But he said, I emailed him your videos, and he emailed me back. So I'm going to share with you his response, a response. We didn't go into this, but I think it's worth noting. And I just want to put his question into the mix here. And hopefully it'll stimulate something. He says, very interesting video. Somehow it escaped me how anti-space Bergson is. I wonder about, he's talking to me, I'm wondering about your take on this with your experience of embodied cognition. He goes on, he seems to be trying to unravel the reification errors we make. I'm not sure if he's talking about you or talking about Bergson. So I apologize if that's not clear. His response is, he seems to be trying to unravel the reification errors we make to free the mind from naive realism. But oddly, I never thought stopping the tendency to spatialize concepts would be a way to do that. I suppose space has always been my friend before time and not the other way around. In some of the Tibetan Yogacara texts, they actually do employ space as a means to liberate their habits. Their ideas of basic space fits very closely in my eyes to Lakoff's take of space and that fundamental metaphor. And also he goes into Jakob Bohm's Ungroomed, though that's probably another rabbit hole that I'm not equipped for. So I'm just bringing that forward just to bring his voice into the mix. And maybe that's of use to us, I don't know.
I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, I touch on a little bit, but I say, you know, we've developed our spatial sense, and it's necessary in part of life. It's of the most importance that we can navigate solids. We can, you know, not run into a tree and stuff. And this works really well for us. The problem is it works so well that we become unaware of time. And all of our formulations of time, as Lakoff would show in his metaphors, are spatial. But that we know in experience that movement, experience, are not reducible. We can't compartmentalize them without changing what they are. So it's that it's more intuitive to think about space, and it obfuscates our awareness of experience. We know what it's like to experience, but we forget that we know because we're bombarded by the utility of space and how useful it is. So that's what I would say to him. I don't know if does that seem to answer to you, or?
Yes, he's not here, but does have a resonance for me, and I will share this video with him so he could respond or do with it what he will. But I think that you mentioned Gebser earlier, and we've done a lot of work on Gebser. So his take on the perspectival mind and how we tend to sort of impose this geometric Euclidean grid on everything, which we inherited from the Renaissance, and it certainly produced some amazing effects, but it could also detach us. The visual system in general can detach us from the acoustic space, yeah, which includes, which has different kinds of boundaries, if any at all. They're very different than the ones that a static visual representation tends to capture. But if we're working as in a kind of holistic orientation, the acoustic space, well, the visual space and the acoustic space can be overlapping in harmonious ways with the sense of touch, smell, and taste. So there would be other senses besides the physical five that, yeah, we can retrieve, that we can reverse things with, that obsolesce certain things, and that amplify others and enhance others. So that's where I believe our sensoriums are like portals to, you, yeah, know, multiple dimensions. That's why I find the posthumanist and transhumanist orientations are so lopsided, because you've already got the most powerful biocomputer on the planet. Why you want to muck it around with this, you know, put on headphones and goggles and, you know, it just distorts or amplifies a kind of visual space that I think will create another wave of people, not most people, but a lot of people will get quite addicted to it. Just as heroin, I understand, only addicts about 8% of the people who use it. But those people that 8% can, you know, drop through that into addiction, into a terrible addiction, which has widespread effects. So I'm just sharing that with us because I think this is one of the things that haunts me with a lot of this posthumanism, transhumanist rhetoric. It's like they're sort of reinventing the wheel. All of this has been around for quite a while. It's a myth. It's very mythic, and it's a grand narrative, and it's very deeply installed in our sensoriums, because we're all online so much, and it is changing our nervous systems. I've been very aware of how certain weird symptoms have started to, crop up in my own physiology, which I had a responsibility. I had to remove myself from Facebook and stop all that tweeting and social media. I just stopped it, and the symptoms disappeared in a few days. So I definitely think there's a cause and effect going on here. So this we can amplify a lot, and we can reverse, and we can obsolesce, and we can do all kinds of working with the tetrads. And I think that this is something that that McLuhan was very, very savvy about, very articulate about. So I would hope we could sort of revive McLuhan and look at Bergson and think about Gebser and this whole, a lot of the impulse behind a lot of our get-togethers and a lot of the books that we've studied has been integral theory. I don't know how familiar you are, Matthew, with integral theory.
I've never read Gebser or who's the proponent of who's the integral guy.
Well, it's not necessary that you do. I think that
Jeremy Johnson, I've listened to podcast interviews with Gebserians. I want to read his book. Yeah. And then who's associated with integral theory these days?
Ken Wilber.
Yes. Ken Wilber. Yeah, I haven't read Ken Wilber at all.
Well, I just think that a lot of the inspiration has been to become more integral, but I'm also of the opinion that I'm listening to a guy, Jason Storm. He just wrote a new book on metamodernism that I'm reading, and I've read other of his books. So I'm just thinking that it gets really problematic when you think there's a group of people who just have these special kind of attributes or qualities called integral. And it could just be another cul-de-sac, you know, people getting stuck in all kinds of labels, unless it gets embodied in some kind of projects that make a difference. I think it can just end up being a pseudo kind of avant-garde they're trying to recreate. And it can become just a, I think it was Nora Bates and someone we've studied, she thinks a lot of it, this meta-modern stuff is just, you know, developmental colonial bullshit, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm alert to that.
I would say, Matt, that you don't need to go and read Ken Wilber. He often repeats himself. He has his own tetrad that might be useful for framing things, like first, second, third person, and also like the in and out, the I, we, it, I guess that's the first, second, third person. So he has a useful tetrad as well, just like we can focus on McLuhan's tetrad, but it's not going to define our entire life. It's a useful framework.
I think you're right, and I really appreciate you saving me from going into that rabbit hole, the integral rabbit hole. But I think it's sort of how we label ourselves is going to become sort of increasingly important. But I think that's why I like the digital age. It doesn't have to be integral, it doesn't have to be meta-modern. It can be, I like McLuhan's digital age because it's sort of doing the same thing, but it's just using something a little less contentious. And also there's this one, this little chart I just drew out from Bernard Castrop's latest book.
Oh, yes.
He's talking about will at large. And he's introspecting. He's looking at perceptual representations, abstract representations, and he's looking at the physical world, and he's doing it philosophically. But I'm like a practitioner, I'm not a philosopher, so I'm very interested in the perceptual space and the conceptual space and the relationship between the conceptual and the perceptual and what happens when we go into those neither nor spaces and what happens when we re-perceive and reconceive. So, I think that that's the capacity to be able to handle that kind of attention, attention and tension is increasingly important to my life because it's, you know, and everyone has to figure out what the ecology is for them. I mean, it's not easy to figure this out, especially during this pandemic, which has locked down so many people. So I just so glad that we had this chance to hang out today and figure out what we would like to do next. And so I would just, before we close, just ask you guys, what have you learned today from this exchange? What would you, what difference does that make? And maybe what would happen next?
Sorry, I had to step out for a few minutes, so I might have missed when you were reading Seth's response. So did you get a chance to respond to that, Matt?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, I'll go back and watch that. I was interested in, because, I like what Seth was getting at there, and I know that's exactly what you were looking at from your videos was feedback and feedback loops. Of kind of getting into deeper conversations and finding your potential blind spots or where others have issues. So, and that's where I see what we do here, other than labeling it as cafe get together.
Yeah.
We don't have a label. We might come from the integral perspective, or we might come from Bergson or Kastrup, but that doesn't mean we're going to be analytical idealist exploring this only from analytical point of view. There's none of that going on. And I think that's what's beautiful about us. We don't need to label ourselves. And I think that so that's kind of what I'm learning, and I've always learned, and I'm relearning, is that So you mentioned getting away from Twitter. You mentioned getting away from forums of that nature. We're taking this conversation from a YouTube forum, taking it away from that into a new form of communication. And that's really what I learned from each time. So our individual perspectives, we're a triad here. There's the missing fourth, which is going to be the listener. So there's the tetrad, and perhaps one of us will listen to us. And what does that mean to be a fourth entity entering into a tetrad? So there's always food for thought that's entering into the conversation. And I like the direction we're going. I think we gave direction. I don't want to say that we're going to read this or that book just yet. I'd like to hear others' opinions that often want to participate, like Ed and Michael, Marco. We haven't heard from others like Lisa and Heather. It seems like they're pretty busy as well, but I think they would like to know what we're discussing or potentially discussing. I hope we can bring it all together, and I would like to focus on perhaps one book. If it's just the three of us reading Bergsonism or a Deleuze book or something like that, that'd be perfectly fine with me. But we'll continue to gauge others' interest as well, because we obviously have plenty to talk about, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of exactly the best outcome I could have hoped for my video. I had a desire to share my enthusiasm, but also a desire to make connections. And I've been even just being added into the forum and reading what you guys are talking about and watching some of the videos you've done and participating in that conversation, my thought is already expanded. I continually remind myself that it's not about arriving at a static position, but it's about being agile. And doing it alone, you're at constant risk of becoming static. Entering into these kind of fields of difference, you promote agility and newness. And I'm excited to continue to talk with you guys. And thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you very much, both of you. And I guess my concluding thoughts about all this, I'm just what's coming to me, right before the pandemic, I was in it was uptown at the Helix Center. And there were some very distinguished panelists and, you know, a large group, all these New Yorkers hanging out. And I think Bram Harman was sitting right next to me. I don't know if you know the philosopher.
Yeah, I know.
So it was a very distinguished crowd. And at the end of the panel discussion, there's a microphone, an open mic for people to go up. And I went up there and I said something, I can't remember exactly what I said, but there was something about, I said, when I was a kid watching TV, I watched The Twilight Zone. And at the beginning of it, there's this comment, do 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 do, and there's this something about the fifth dimension, or maybe it's the fourth dimension. We're from the fourth or the fifth dimension, and I said, you know, I remember those days. I'm sure there are a lot of people there who did as well. And I said, now, right before this was recorded, this event, we knew it was being recorded and it was going to be uploaded onto YouTube. I said, there was an announcement that this was going to happen. So, and we were invited to think about our participation with that knowledge that this was going to be uploaded and put on YouTube. Okay, mm-hmm. So my question is, had something to do with the receiver and the perceiver and that first person. And you're entering into a forum where first persons are discussing third person, discussing first person. Mm. And then there's my experience of that, 10-year-old watching Twilight Zone. And I can be thinking about, I'm here in front of everybody talking to you with a microphone. And I can also be thinking about the persons who are not here, who are watching this video because it's streamed live. And I can be thinking about the person that I will be in the future who looks at this video, which I'm participating in right now. So I think this is something that's new in our experience, socially and culturally as well. And there were some comments that were made. They were a little over my head. I didn't quite get what they were all talking about, but I could go back and I could watch the video. So anyway, I'm sharing that with you guys because I don't think every conversation we had needs to be recorded, but the ones that are recorded, and if we do pay attention to them, it's awfully interesting. My experience, wow, I missed that. So much was going by so fast, I just totally missed it. So thank you guys. I've really enjoyed this a lot. I hope we'll do more of this and do it even better. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, definitely. I guess see you at the forum. I'll have this posted hopefully sometime today once I've got a little bit of work to do, but
then we can look at it and we can think about how we can support Matthew's work if he wants our support. I think it would be great if we maybe made a look at the if we looked at the videos and got together and did a little more deeper dive than we were able to do today. If we can make that our intention.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah, very awesome. Good.
All right, so guys. Have a great day.
Yeah. We'll make it happen. Thank you all.
We'll be in touch. See you guys.